Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. Getting used to remote recording now, in one way or another. A huge welcome to our special guest for the podcast this morning, Lara O'Reilly, Senior Correspondent with DigiDay. Hi, Lara.
Hello.
It's actually really delightful to have you on the podcast because so very often we are referencing you and your DigiDay colleagues and the articles that you've written in our news roundup. So we're actually going to be able to hear straight from the horse's mouth.
Excellent. Well, that's good to hear.
And joining us from her Walthamstow studios, Lindsay Rowntree, Head of Comsnet with ExchangeWire. How's it going over there, Lindsay?
Good. Very good. I'm very echoey. I'm sorry. I've been told I need to sit under a duvet to dull the sound, but I'm not doing that.
Yeah, we just had that chat, didn't we? I'm not going to do that either. I just, it just sort of speaks of suffocation to me, really.
I don't need that right now.
No, not on top of everything else.
Exactly.
And Lara, it's good to see. I'm enjoying your background. It's good to see the guitar on the wall in the background there. Who's the guitarist? Is that you or a family member, housemate?
I kind of dabble with it. We share it. Me and my boyfriend share it. We used to, ages ago, be in a band, but too old.
Amazing.
Yeah, I think that's an opportunity. We could have done a bit of a musical. Maybe we might get you to crack into that in the second part of the podcast. What are you up to in amongst?
Yeah, when we get to the delirium stage, I'll start singing and dancing.
You can aid us, Lara. That'd be fun.
That would be amazing. Cool. Okay, so let's move on to discussion of the news stories this week. Of course, the world that we're currently living in is just dominating not just the news, but the way in which news about other things is filtering through to us as well. So this is going to be a very familiar backdrop for our stories today to everybody that's listening. I wanted to start with a conversation about the impact of the pandemic on ad spend at the moment. We've talked about this in the last 2 weeks podcast as well, because obviously it's just, such big news. An internal conversation at ExchangeWire this morning reminded me that whenever anything big happens in the world that sort of results in a contraction of ordinary activity, it feels like the advertising and marketing industry caught that first, because it's one of the first things that seems to falter. So I suppose it's right that we just have a bit of a summary on where we're at this week as opposed to last week and previous weeks with regards to ad spend. So the stories that I wanted to highlight under this sort of little subtitle is a couple of stories coming through this week from Campaign, one focusing on the prediction in the drop in advertising activity in the UK market, 50% for April. Then there's also a news story about WPP's approach to keeping their business viable during these times, which is taking a wide-ranging list of measures, from reducing the number of awards that they're submitting through to senior executives taking a 20% salary drop and recruitment freezes across the board, which no doubt says something about how they're weathering this current storm. And then there was also an article from the Economic Times in India reporting that Google and Facebook are set to lose something like $44 million in terms of advertising revenue.
Billion.
Thank you. Yeah, right. Yeah, million's not enough. Good point. In 2020. So I wanted to get an impression from you guys as to what kind of a picture that's painting for us. It's obviously, pretty depressing and potentially quite scary for a lot of people in the industry. But I'm wondering how much of this is related to activity that's a direct result of the pandemic, and activity that actually perhaps was going to come down the line as we start to see a bit of a constriction in advertising spend because we're heading into a recession, which may have been on our tails anyway. And then what you think this is going to do for some of the big companies in our industry that we spend a lot of time talking about. So that's the dominant technology companies, but also what it's going to do to our big advertising holding group. So Lara, over to you first. What's your perspective on this particular picture at the moment?
Where to begin? This is obviously just so much bigger than the advertising industry, and every single business is affected. And even if you're a supermarket that's making hay at the moment, you're likely not advertising products and so on, because you're worried about fulfillment and the logistics of getting things to people. I mean, in terms of how the ad market is going to react, so I have heard from agency sources in the UK that kind of 50% figure as well. And to point out, that's not just for April, that's for the year.
Yeah, right.
I mean, we're not, it's kind of silly to make too many predictions because every day is different at the moment. But the likelihood is this isn't going away anytime soon. And, you know, 2020 is just kind of free-falling, you know, a free-falling nightmare. And then 2021 is probably going to be carnage too. And then you might only really start seeing a recovery in 2022. So you're looking at a Great Depression, ultimately. So with all that in mind, just so if you look at, say, okay, what WPP's doing, for example, like that's the first step that most companies are going to be doing right now. Like I wrote a story this week about how the agency CFO is the new superstar at agencies.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Whereas it once used to be like the CEO or the, you know, the chief client officer or the chief creative officer. But it's not just at advertising companies. Every CFO at the moment is looking at the balance sheet and going, what can we cut? What is in the accounts payables that we don't want to see in there next month? So that's everything from, so obviously, you know, award shows, you're not paying anything on travel at the moment, but that comes down to software contracts. You know, look, like the Cheesecake Factory in the US isn't paying rent next month. Like, so there are going to be so many companies that are not going to pay their building costs because nobody's using them. And also it's another outgoing that you can easily get rid of. So it's, you know, this affects every company. You know, Disney, Bob Iger's not taking a salary at the moment. It's so big and so huge that, again, this isn't just about the ad industry often serves as the canary in the coal mine for a lot of things. It is interesting that you're seeing things like the UK ad market dropping off 50%. The economy ain't going to do too great either. And we're already seeing, you know, GDP, you know, Bank of America cut its predictions for GDP growth in Europe down to 7.6% today, which was like a 540 basis point revision in just a couple of weeks. They haven't got any data either. Like, bankers don't even know what's going to happen. So sorry, that was just a long way of saying just this is a very big thing that's impacting every single person, every single company in every single country on earth. So not to be like a Debbie Downer, but it's not looking good, and it's going to go on for a long time.
That's beyond Debbie Downer, really. I mean, but I can't see what you've just said. I can't see anything that's illogical there, because I think the biggest underlying issue here, and you hit upon it, is that we can't predict anything. Every single day the situation is changing, and no matter what corner of the world that you're sitting in, whether that's over in APAC where they've already been through a bit of a mini crisis and things have kind of calmed down a little bit, but now you can start to see that curve sort of heading upwards again, and there's concerns about, you know, a second wave of infections, or whether it's over here and you're very keenly watching what's happening in neighbouring European countries to try to see some glimmers of hope in terms of transmission slowdowns and what that then might mean for lockdown, etc. At the end of the day, absolutely none of this is predictable at this stage, and it's just throwing such a question mark over every single industry in every single corner of the world. Lindsay?
Yeah, so to echo Debbie Downer over there, I feel like, everything Laura said is, I can't even say I agree with it, it is fact, exactly what's going on. I think to bring it back to the digital industry, it's interesting that obviously talking about drops, talking about what big companies are doing to try to stem this, and Lara's article on the CFO becoming almost the most valuable player in any company now, because they are the ones that can try and help in the best way possible to try and bring some companies out of this hole that they are swiftly falling in, it brings a whole new meaning to kind of the challenges of procurement within a company now, and kind of what their most important role is in terms of helping like level out the finances in the company. I think I want to cite, so we talked about this in the past, but when looking at the kind of the APAC region, like Laura was talking about a global depression, I think that's true. I think 2020 will ultimately be a write-off. And we have to just accept it's going to be a write-off. And there are obviously schools of thought that go, you know, H2 will start looking better. Q4 will see a massive boost because people will have money put away because they've not been going out spending it. That could be true for some parts of the world, but for other parts of the world and other classes and levels, there'll be no money at all because everyone's lost their jobs or they've been furloughed or had to kind of go on tax benefits. So I think we don't have a clue what we're going to look at. And Rachel, I remember a conversation I had with you about people you were chatting to in APAC when you were last in Singapore, saying that, you know, we lived through this already with SARS. And with SARS, SARS was terrifying for us as it was because it was a very deadly virus. But also 2020 was a write-off. We literally had to just kind of look at the balance sheet of that year and go, nah, let's forget about that and let's move on to the next year. So I think that people will have to look at that and go, okay, whatever happens this year, we have to ride it. Let's put our focus on what 2021 could look like. Also, interestingly, the webcast that's viewed, I'm going to say yesterday, based on when this is going out, Kieran did with Tom Simpson from Ad Colony. And it was interesting to me that he talked about the digital percentage of total media in APAC versus the rest of the world. So over here and in the US, we're looking at around 60% of all media is digital, sometimes more, but it's certainly high, and it keeps increasing year after year. He said in APAC, that's still only around 20-30%, which has meant that digital has remained largely protected. And yes, there has been money being pulled out of the likes of out of home and the likes of TV. And obviously advertisers are unsure about budgets. So budgets are being cut. But because digital was only a smaller portion of that in the first place, they haven't seen the same slashes in digital budget that we're seeing out in the West, which is very interesting. So I think it shows that there is still money to be put into digital. It's just helping people understand where and how they can make the most of it. They're trying to remove frivolous spend, basically, but there is still spend to be had. So there's a lot of conversations that could be had around where that could go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's interesting the point that you raise about SARS, because that conversation that I had back in February, I think it was the very beginning of February in Singapore, was with a guy who was ex-Unilever and had been working at Unilever during SARS, so quite a long time ago. And he talked about how terrifying it was from a marketer's perspective in a big CPG. And, of course, the crisis didn't last anywhere near as long as this crisis is currently unfolding and looking like it's going to last. But it made me think that actually maybe this will be different. This will be experienced differently depending on who you are. I mean, there are, you know, not just sort of glibly trying to look for opportunity in otherwise pretty depressing sort of landscape. There are still some people spending money in some areas. It's just that our lives have changed so significantly. Again, it's impossible to predict how that's going to unfold from here onwards. So, you know, you are seeing the likes of perhaps some e-commerce companies and perhaps some smaller digital brands getting some share of spend. You are seeing people still consuming some things at home. It could even be the likes of, you know, there's obviously online gaming, which we'll go on to in a little while because we've got another story coming up about that. But, you know, it could even be the likes of traditional games, that people are buying those to get them delivered to the house, to keep the kids occupied, all of those sorts of things. But it's that, it's also unknown, like that will be what people are doing now, but are we going to still be in this sort of phase of lockdown for the next couple of months? Is it going to be longer than the next couple of months? Actually, might we see some restrictions lifted in the coming, say, 4 weeks? That means that some things will start to go back to normal. And this is also notwithstanding some other developments that we're keenly, you know, awaiting news on a day-by-day basis. What if an antibody test turns up and then we can suddenly work out who actually has had it and is immune and can go back to work and can carry on their ordinary lives? And so that's why it makes conversations that we're having about what this looks like today, you know, really difficult, because what it looks like today might not be what it looks like in a couple of weeks' time. Lara, from your point of view, have you been having conversations with either agencies or maybe even marketers who've expressed things in more of an acute way, saying this is what we're doing now, but we can only do this for a certain period of time. We've then got to change our strategy for another month or two's time.
Yeah, I think so the first reaction is to go into kind of shock mode and pull everything that you can. And digital spend is the easiest kind of lever that you can just switch off immediately. TV, you bought up front, you have to kind of stay with those commitments. I think what most CFOs at both agencies and, you know, within big companies and brands as well are doing is they're trying to forecast for the next 90 days, but with a view that things change and you're probably going to have to reforecast every week. When it comes to, when it comes to kind of spending, I guess we're on like an advertising podcast. So like, I think you're absolutely right. Obviously there's been a change in behavior, you know, everybody's lives have been upended and there are some companies that will help fill the void of boredom or will help, more significantly in other ways. And obviously media consumption's up. So, and, you know, grifters are going to grift, right? Like you have seen a bunch of like these, I don't know if you just even go on like premium sites at the moment, you will see some really crappy e-commerce ads in top slots, in the masthead slots. And there is, you know, there are short-term advantages in buying on digital media at the moment because CPMs are down because a bunch of big marketers have pulled their spend altogether because they're worrying about what to do and worrying about conserving cash. And we haven't spoken about like the keyword blocking problem, loads, the brand safety, alleged brand safety issue of appearing next to coronavirus stories, which is ridiculous because the only story at the moment is coronavirus. So where else are you going to advertise? Like, there aren't any travel pages to advertise on at the moment. You know, there are not many people are reading about sports. Like, coronavirus is the story. Like, get with it. And I know this is self-serving, but we need to support news businesses at the moment because it's vital that trustworthy information gets out there. But that, all of that means that you've got big brands not spending or big brands not appearing in these high profile places. I mean, people are even blocking home pages, like the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and The Guardian. People, you know, those ad slots are being blocked on brand safety concerns. So there are, as I say, there are opportunities to be had because the CPMs are lower and there's loads of traffic at the moment. So you can reach a lot of people a lot more cheaply.
Yeah, and surely that sort of approach has got to stop, the notion of just blocking coronavirus unilaterally as a keyword, because like you say, there is no other content out there. I mean, you know, no one's writing about sport because no one's playing sport. There aren't any sporting games going on. There is literally nothing else going on. Now, I can understand if you're a travel brand, that might be different. But if you're another type of brand, surely, you know, like you say, maybe you're not necessarily doing this today, but in the coming weeks, you've got to start thinking about how you can reorganize your business a little bit and get some messages out there and be prepared to appear against some of this content, because otherwise there's nowhere to appear.
Yeah, exactly that. And there's a notion that you have to kind of keep your brand out there and in people's minds. Otherwise, you know, if you pause and suddenly go away, people will forget about you. And then in 6 months' time or in 12 months' time, when some semblance of normality returns, someone else has stolen all your share of voice, one of your competitors, because they did decide to keep advertising through it. And you've got to rebuild all over again. So you get the kind of double blow. So there is a kind of argument that spending through these types of periods, I mean, obviously, you know, controlled spending, not going crazy, not spending kind of like Super Bowl ad amount of money on things, especially, and obviously not if you're a travel brand or, you know, your entire business has been decimated. But there is an argument for just trying to maintain your share of voice at the moment. The thing you have to just be careful of is, what are you going to say? And the most important thing right now is people need information. And they need reassurance and they need to be helped. So if your brand can do any of those three things, you know, now's your time to shine.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. Lindsay?
Yeah, I think I agree with that. The notion about maintaining your brand presence during this time is an important one. If we look back to the global financial crisis in 2008, there is evidence to suggest that the brands that came out looking the best were the ones that remained visible that entire time. As Lara says, if you disappear, then when this is all over, who are you? And you have to go through the process of trying to rebuild your brand visibility all over again. And that would be more challenging and it could cost you more money in the long run. So it's an interesting point about what is the right message? What should you go out there saying? Because the other problem is people will not forget. So those companies that don't look after their staff, those companies that say the wrong message, those companies that have an ad going live that it's impossible to, that they haven't pulled back on, they haven't changed it with something that's more appropriate to the current climate, those are things that will not be forgotten. They will be screenshotted the hell out of, they will be shared, but also they will remain in public sentiment for some time. So it's really important that if you are remaining out there, you do so really thinking about what your message is. At the moment, that isn't about you having, that isn't about your brand and the products you sell. It's about you as a brand supporting companies, supporting individuals, supporting the vulnerable, and that's probably the way to go forward. And if you're going to put money anywhere, it's probably in doing those kinds of things. But I think the keyword blocking thing that we talked about is an interesting thing too, because blocking coronavirus assumes that every single piece of news on coronavirus is negative news, which actually isn't the case either. There's plenty content out there about how to make the most of surviving a pandemic, how to make the most of self-isolation. So all these kind of tips about hobbies you can start and all this kind of stuff. And there's also good news stories about drugs that are being made available, about advancements in testing, about countries that are coming out the other side of it. There is new good news, non-negative Crohn stories out there. So I think brands need to start evaluating what they're looking at. And if that's moving away from keyword blocking, it's a big step for them, moving away from keyword blocking and looking at more tools that can help them semantically, contextually. They're the ones that will help them get through this. So if they don't want to appear against an article mired by death results, but they do want to appear against something that's more positive through this, then contextual and semantic targeting is the ideal way forward. But brands are just too scared because, again, people don't forget. But I think in this context, as long as your ad is the right ad, you'll be forgiven for showing an ad that's against something, a negative news story, because ultimately a lot of it is negative.
Yeah, and I think I can totally understand why as a marketer you might be very nervous at the moment and you really are assessing perhaps on a minute-by-minute basis what your strategy ought to be. But I think it's possible that we're coming into a period within this crisis where people perhaps are having a moment, an opportunity to sort of stop and reflect and think, okay, either we are doing nothing and we're risking all of the potential consequences of that, or we're doing something and we've then got to, you know, decide how we go forward with that. So I sort of feel like, you know, this has now become pretty much a weekly topic of conversation on the Mad Tech podcast, so it'll be interesting to see where this particular news story is at next week. But I feel like things, we might just be at a point where things are kind of plateauing a little bit in terms of the way that we're all, you know, adapting to the new normal. And so you might actually start seeing some of those brands coming out and investing to advertise in ways that, you know, they feel kind of confident in doing. I'm going to move this on to the next news story because actually the three are kind of quite heavily connected. So we'll return to some of those topics. This is a focus on the opportunities and challenges of streaming and the streaming sort of landscape at the moment. So again, this is something that we've been speaking about the last couple of MadTech podcasts because it's something that's at the forefront of everyone's minds, what we've been spending a lot more quality time in front of our streaming devices than ever before, arguably. I mean, people say that. I don't actually feel like I am watching more telly. I'm kind of doing other things. But anyway, I appreciate that there's an opportunity to watch more telly. So there's a collection of a couple of news stories here, which is a report on Facebook Live experiencing a bit of a surge in viewers. This has come from one of your colleagues, Lara Seb Joseph, who we often quote in our Mad Tech podcast news roundup. So that was an interesting piece. Hand in hand with news of Disney Plus launching across Europe over the last couple of weeks with an estimated 5 million app downloads, which is pretty big. Obviously, they offered, you know, free trial periods with that as well to kind of get the users through the door. And there's also the noticeable sort of changes that some of the more familiar streaming services have been making to their offerings, no doubt in order to try to increase either subscription numbers or just try to direct eyeballs towards certain pieces of content. Netflix coming out with their top 10 in your country recommendations, a little bit similar to our Spotify, what we'd all be familiar with in our Spotify profiles. But, you know, so that's sort of the one side of the world of streaming at the moment. The other side to this is that actually the streaming industry, or sorry, I should say the news and entertainment industry, is experiencing just as much challenge as everybody else. And so where you're looking at some of these streaming companies probably doing well because there's more people watching, actually what's happening to the production side of their businesses. So that we know the likes of Netflix and AT&T and Comcast have invested a huge amount of money into creating content that comes at a very hefty price. What's happening when they're in a position where they're not actually able to create that new content, certainly not in a real life context. And I guess that's what partly speaks to the rise in popularity of services like Facebook Live. I think there's also some questions around how people access some of that content. So again, that debate about subscription versus ad funded. All good and well for sub services to be looking to get more subscribers in this particular environment, but there's still going to be a lot of people that are very concerned about their monthly outgoings and are not in a financial position where they're able to take up a subscription. So what's that doing to user numbers across the board? There seems to be an enormous sort of opportunity in various other live platforms. So anything, including the sort of, you know, sort of social platforms, so anything connected to Instagram, TikTok, maybe even LinkedIn in terms of live broadcasting. But, you know, are these opportunities going to create, I suppose, more of an opportunity for advertisers beyond this current set of circumstances that we're in? And also, how are these streaming companies going to navigate their way through this lockdown period, which it strikes me is going to have an enormous impact on their ability to make live content? And also, I suppose a little segue to that is an opinion on, are we going to run out of content? Like, I can't imagine that, but except for that I know friends that work in the television industry are not making any content and writers are not writing more content because stuff can't be filmed and recorded. Lara, what's your point of view?
Yeah, as you say, the production woes are going to be really interesting just to see how that plays out. And I do wonder whether the CGI studios, so the MPCs and others, Frame Stores and so on, are going to be kind of getting loads of business through the door virtually, so to speak, because you can't get people in a physical location at the moment. So I think, yeah, that's going to be really interesting. So what happens when you complete Netflix? So I think we'll see a lot of kind of licensing deals for archive content. At the same time, all of these companies are struggling with the same struggles that everybody else is, in that they're trying to preserve cash at the moment. So it will be interesting to see how big these deals are. And companies like AT&T and Netflix obviously have, and you know, others have, they're really leveraged, so they have lots of debt. I guess the good thing they have in their, you know, to their advantage versus smaller companies is kind of better credit ratings than others. Although I saw just the other day that Disney's credit rating was revised down by Fitch recently over obviously the issues that they're going to have in their parks businesses. I think there's, you know, it's just another one of these phenomenons that has just been accelerated by the pandemic. I mean, the interesting one, and my colleague Seb, who we referenced earlier, read about the other day, was the kind of surprising spike in Facebook Live viewing. Just surprising in that it wasn't, it hadn't necessarily been a success story for Facebook compared to others. But obviously people are looking for ways in which they can, from the creator side, you're looking at new ways to connect to your audience So you're seeing, I don't know if it's the same as you, but I'm seeing so many Instagram lives as well, Instagram live stories. Yeah. So many in a way that nobody really did them before. They were kind of a bit odd. Yeah. But obviously you've just got a captive audience at the moment because people aren't going around doing other things.
And I wonder if, do you think it's also because there might be a bit more of a craving amongst, you know, those of us who are extroverted and feel, you know, detached from the usual network of people that we might see in real life? Do you think that that's what's seeing a bit of an uptick in anything live?
Oh, completely. And I just also think, like, for a lot of these influencers, they don't have a lot of work at the moment. So they, you know, they're not rushing to and from meetings with agents and traveling around the world. So they need to do something to kind of keep their name and their voice out there. And, you know, you're seeing the rise of TikTok and people being really creative on that platform.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, perhaps they might not have put the effort in before. And now, you know, you've just got oodles of time to cut video.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, like on the creative side, I'm seeing some fantastic things. Like, you know, someone sent me a clip yesterday of a collection of classical musicians in France who couldn't play together. So they played and recorded separately and then had that edited together. And it was fantastic. And it does make you start thinking, okay, maybe there are other ways to present this content, certainly whilst we've got no other choices. Lindsay, what's your point of view on the state of the world of streaming?
Well, I think this will tell you everything you need to know. I am this close to downloading TikTok.
Oh, shit.
but to be fair to TikTok, they're doing pretty well on the old ad front. Like in terms of in-app gaming, where we'll talk about later, as you said, Rachel, everyone's spending their time. The TikTok ads are actually really engaging. And they just it's just simple videos that they show as an ad. And you kind of go, oh, that's a cool video. Oh, there's some quite cool stuff on this. Maybe I'll download it. But like, I just can't bring myself to take that step of actually searching for it in the app store and downloading it. But I feel like I might very soon.
If you do though, Lindsay, and then the next time I see you in real life, you're doing some weird quirky TikTok dance, there will be trouble.
No, I suppose it's going to be, you'll love it. You'll love it. I mean, to echo kind of your point, I think that there is this, there's tons of content out there. And Laura, you mentioned completing Netflix. I mean, honestly, how can you complete Netflix? It is full of crap. Like, there's no way, surely, you could complete Netflix, even if you're in isolation for the next sort of 3 months. Like, there's still a lot of stuff on there that, in desperation, I'm sure people would watch. But I think there's also this just need for people to feel close to people, like, in a live environment. And that's why Facebook Live just must be doing so well, because that there's an example of a DJ that's done really well, and he got a million people to kind of tune into his live DJ set. And I think people feel like they're actually close to people and experience the same thing at the same time, which is what we used to feel when we listened to the radio, when we watched TV at the same time together, which we don't have anymore because everyone's streaming everything. So just that sense of closeness to somebody when you're not actually physically next to them, I think is going to play a big part in this. And that's where Facebook Live will do really, really well. And maybe other platforms could use them as an example. But I also think Facebook Live is good for publishers that are trying to understand how they can diversify their revenue streams. So if they can get some of their editors or some of their journalists to start doing live content, live video content, I think that'd be amazing, because they've, like companies like BuzzFeed, these next generation publishers, they tried with Facebook Live when it first launched and it didn't go very well. But now it's an opportunity where you've got a massive audience, and it's a really diversified audience probably as well. There's a huge opportunity there. I think in terms of streaming in general, Laura, you mentioned that they're all massively leveraged and they have to try and make the most of their streaming offerings to offset the losses they're making elsewhere. You know, think of the losses being made in advertising, losses from the Olympics, for example, obviously Disney and Disney Parks, Laura, you mentioned, there's a lot of things that they're going to have to work out. And I feel like the one company through all this, while they're losing out on handset revenue massively, but they are very, very cash rich, is Apple. So in streaming, I'm interested to see what Apple could do in this and how they could take advantage of it, because their streaming platform, Apple TV, is still quite nascent. So there's probably still quite a lot of stuff they could do there and stuff they could do as virtual promotion. So that's an interesting one for me to watch.
I think it's drawing on something that you mentioned as well, Lara, is it almost feels like it's an acceleration of this current scenario, is an acceleration of perhaps some of the challenges that those streaming businesses were going to be coming across in the coming months anyway, or 12 months or so. We've been talking for ages about whether Netflix will be forced to go to an ad-funded model, even at least outside the US, just because of complications and difficulties in growing their subscriber base within the US, and then complications or rather challenges growing their subscriber base in countries where incomes are a lot lower. You know, we've been talking about how expensive it is to, you know, to produce original content, and whether actually Disney's got an upper hand there because they already own content studios and they already own and like a lot of, you know, original content. But there again, they've got the challenge of all of their theme parks being closed and their merchandise sales obviously being significantly impacted as a result. So I wonder if this situation is just sort of bringing to the forefront all of those challenges within the business models within these streaming companies, because at the moment it feels like anyone who is heavily reliant on anything face-to-face is really exposed. And that seems like such a weird thing to say, doesn't it? Because, you know, there's no way we would be saying something, a sentence like that this time last year. We might have said, oh, yeah, I can see challenges around trying to grow a subscriber base. I can see how it's really expensive to run a content studio. But I don't think any of us ever thought we'd be in a scenario where someone said, yeah, but imagine that you can't do either of those things. Imagine you can't physically get into a studio. You can't physically put actors together. You can't physically create that content in the same way that you ordinarily would. I mean, that just would have been unimaginable a while ago. But now we're in a position where that's what everyone has kind of got to contemplate, I suppose. Do you think it's really going to shake up those streaming companies? What's your point of view on that, Lara?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's important to point out, so some of what's going on is an accelerant of trends that were already happening.
Yeah,
and then some of what's going on is a reaction to a very shocking thing that we don't know how long it will go on for. But, you know, some semblance of normality will return at some point. Like, people will go back outside again, and, you know, people will probably go back to cinemas again and so on, maybe in fewer numbers. I mean, it's certainly, you know, it's a shock. And again, like some of these things, we don't know how it will play out and how much this will affect society afterwards too. And I've used this in a column I wrote recently, but there's like the famous like Warren Buffett quote around like, you only find out who's swimming naked when the tide goes out. And I think, yeah, you're certainly going to see a lot of this coming to light a lot more quickly. When I say this, I just mean like, you know, the competition at the moment for all of these streaming services and who's going to win and who isn't, you know, who was struggling, etc. But so similarly to the point about like production will come back again. We're not just going to be watching cartoons for like 20 years. You know, some of this stuff will come back. It will be depleted for a while. It might, certain things might change. But yeah, so some things will eventually come back. We just don't know when, and we just don't know how badly it will be hit. Whereas I think some other trends may linger, but we don't actually know which ones. And you know, when we come out of the lockdown, we don't know. You know, there'll be a period, I suppose, when people are nervous to go out, or people don't want to meet in big groups and don't want to go to festivals for a short while. And yeah, you just don't know how long that will last, and will it change just people's behaviour for the long term? But I know that's a really like crap answer. Like, we don't know. That's like the worst thing. But, like, there is just no visibility on any of this stuff. But I think, the bigger companies and the ones that have the most cash are the ones that are going to come out of this healthier than the smaller ones who don't have those kind of cash reserves.
Yeah, you're totally right about that. But I think it's a reasonable, you know, in our defence, it's a reasonable point of conversation that actually a lot of what we're talking about at the moment is just surmising and not even predicting, because I think we've all agreed that it's impossible to predict at the moment, but just imagining how things could unfold. And you're right, the companies with the big cash reserves will be in a better position for sure. But I do wonder about the longevity of some business models, and they might even be business models that we didn't think were didn't have longevity in them, but we're thinking about them differently now, and we might do for quite some time to come as a result of this. Because you say we're not all going to be watching cartoons for the rest of our lives. I mean, I can't imagine that we would either. But a friend of mine is a computer animator over in Sydney, and he said his animation studio has never had more pictures put to them by producers and content providers than ever before, to the extent that he's actually said to one of their big producers, what the hell is going on? Yeah. And they've said, they're a production company that have said, we've got loads of people that wanted to produce in real life content and they can't, so they're wanting to convert it to animation. Now, I can't imagine suddenly, you know, EastEnders is the animated version, but you just never know. You never know.
The dot cotton would actually come back.
Yeah. Well, this is it. Think of the possibilities. They're endless.
You can record it from a living room. That'd be great. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's obviously an extreme example. But I wonder if it might uncover some appetite for things that we didn't realise was there. A little bit like even just the social live platforms. You're quite right. They're really good points. No one cared very much about Facebook Live when it first launched. We all thought that LinkedIn Live was a bit creepy to start with. Now it's got a completely different appeal. And maybe that might hang around for a while, not least of all because, like you say, people's habits are going to change a little bit, and there's bound to be at least a period of time where people feel that they need to be careful about taking up some of the things that they used to do without even thinking about it. But it might actually also be that people adapt to these new platforms and find some value in them.
Yeah, I think this is the new normal. But I think there's no kind of after this, once it is over, like this won't be over in terms of it will just evolve. So every day will be a new normal. Yeah. And I don't think we'll ever properly get back to the way that things used to be. Everything will be slightly different. Like who the hell is going to book a package holiday a year in advance? Nobody, because they'll be terrified that something could happen again, and they won't. So these last-minute type companies like Secret Escape, lastminute.com, probably do really well out of this because everyone's going to want to book their holiday 2 days in advance. They're never going to plan anything in advance again because you can't risk to. So I think that everything is going to change slightly, and we will just keep living a new normal each passing day.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And imagine what it's going to do to industries like the insurance industry, because virtually no one, no matter what it is, whether it's travel related or business related, has been able to get any coverage for anything to do with the pandemic. And what that's made me do on a business level, as well as a personal level, is think, so actually, what is the point of insurance if it's not going to cover me when something really bad happens that I might actually need coverage for? So you might find that those industries have to reinvent a little bit the way that they do things. So I'm not saying they're all going to race to put piece together pandemic policies, but they might have to redo things, because for years and years we've been buying travel insurance either in little bits and pieces per trip or maybe annually, really cheaply, but not really delving into the detail of what it covers. Will you bother to pay for that at all if actually you're not booking trips 12 months in advance, so you actually don't know where you're going 12 months in advance? So I'm not going to buy 12 months worth of travel insurance, and I'm not going to buy it for that small trip over there, because the things that are going to happen I can probably cover myself anyway, and the things that I won't cover, they're not going to cover for me. Just things like that might change the way that lots of industries work, I guess. Yeah. Okay, moving us on to the third story for the week, which is the spike in gaming that has been sort of accelerated, overused word in this podcast, by the set of circumstances that we find ourselves in, lockdown and not being able to necessarily connect in person. And I just wanted to chat through a couple of news stories that have come out around the world of gaming this week. The first is that, reports that there was a 62% surge in App Store downloads for gaming in China during the period of lockdown, which is a pretty significant surge. And also stories that we've seen companies, big name gaming companies, King, Activision Blizzard, Zynga, partner together with the WHO to provide some form of social gaming as a way to enable people to overcome the challenges of isolation and so forth. King have even gone as far to start offering people free lives. Yeah, I know, Lindsay's really staring at me now. Lives?
Yeah, lives.
I know lives is the plural of life, but I just, in this, in a gaming context, I wondered if there's a, never mind, anyway. Good to see the comedy of the Mad Tech podcast is still with us. Anyway, they're giving away free lives, I suppose, as a way to contribute to the kind of goodwill nature of that campaign, but also to increase the numbers of people playing games on their platforms. We were in our live webcast on Thursday morning, having a chat, as Lindsay mentioned earlier on, with Tom Simpson from Ad Colony and APAC. He says there's never a better time, there's never been a better time to be involved in the world of mobile gaming. So we know that it's becoming a more popular form.
He would say that.
Of course he would say that. Exactly. But so what I wanted to chat about here was where the actual opportunities are for the world of advertising and marketing in gaming, right? Because we've been talking about this anecdotally for the last sort of 12 to 18 months, how it's a channel that advertisers should be making more use of, what's preventing them from getting involved in those channels, their concerns around, fraud, and brand safety, are those still reasonable, legitimate concerns in this day and age? What does the gaming demographic look like? Where are the opportunities for ad tech providers in this as well? You know, what kind of sort of tools and solutions could be refined and offered more in that mobile gaming environment? So, is this interest in mobile gaming just something that's going to help bring the opportunities of mobile gaming a bit further forward for advertisers and marketers more quickly than it was already going to? What say you, Lara?
Yeah, I think marketers sadly often kind of lag trends. So what we're hearing is just that, it just takes time for marketers to see things as an opportunity and then to move their dollars there. There's a lot of kind of like step repeat with marketing activity. Like, I spent 10 million on TV last year, I'll spend 10 million on it this year, and that kind of thing. To your point, I think there has been up until now, it's still now, an issue around quality, safety, fraud. You do see a lot of ad fraud taking place on mobile games, and just sometimes, just frankly, the quality of mobile games isn't great. You've obviously got amazing ones, the Pokemon Go and some of the stuff that King and Activision Blizzard and Zynga and so on do. But there's a whole world of crap in Google Play. I think marketers often don't really understand the gaming audience. There's still this kind of stereotypical misnomer that gamers are teenage boys. So I think all of that together just means it might just be a little while until this spike turns into ad dollars, essentially.
Yeah. And do you think that's, if we're thinking about the marketer's perspective, do you think that the reason that they haven't got involved in gaming to the extent that they might now find themselves doing is mostly step and repeat, as opposed to, I can see that there's an opportunity there? Because it's very difficult to do things differently, right? I think if nothing else, that's something that we've learnt out of this crisis, every single one of us, how much of what we do in our day-to-day lives we just do because we've always been doing it, until somebody tells you can't do it anymore, you never think to stop. And do you think that's what's happened with marketers and gaming? Because it's been an opportunity for a while. Why aren't more of them into it?
Well, I think just kind of everything I said before, but also often just the creative opportunity isn't great. Like, there's still a lot of reliance on kind of interstitials and banners and things like that, and that's not very appealing sometimes. I think there's maybe just an assumption that you don't want to be an interruptive experience, or that the only thing I can advertise is my app rather than something else. Perhaps there's a kind of misnomer that you can't do brand advertising within these environments, because you do. I mean, often within mobile games, the majority of advertising is advertising other apps. To Lindsay's point earlier, like TikTok is spending like billio at the moment on I think TikTok is Snapchat's biggest advertiser at the moment, as an example. I know that's not mobile gaming, but I think it's often just kind of app advertising and people perhaps need to think more broadly. If there's an audience here and they're engaged and they're just like one thumb tap away from going to your experience, it's certainly worth a try.
Yeah. Lindsay?
Yeah, totally agree with what Laura said. And I think that the reason that we're seeing such major activity from apps like TikTok is because they are apps themselves. They get it. Apps understand in-app advertising, so they're able to comfortably embrace it. And it's the non-app advertisers that don't get it. And it's, you know, we talk about the year of the goddamn mobile for about a decade. And actually, if you look at the stats now, actually, we still haven't hit the year of the mobile because we were talking about from a mobile web perspective. Mobile web is useless because it's still, for many people, embarrassingly just allowing on a media plan, and what they do on desktop they'll do on mobile web as well. And actually, if we really want to embrace the year of the mobile, we should be looking at in-app. And Laura gave some great examples of the areas where education is required. Like she actually said the words that, you know, brands don't understand the gaming audience. And the frustration there is the gaming audience is already their audience. Like, they're no different. Like, I play in-app games and I'm advertised by these brands in every other facet, but they don't touch me in the mobile gaming environment, where arguably I am far more engaged. The number of times I will watch a full ad and actually click on the ad, be it a gaming ad, be it a non-gaming ad, is actually, for me, quite surprising. I'm quite surprised at how engaged I find myself in that environment. So I feel there's so much opportunity that they just need to be able to understand. Yes, brand safety and fraud is a huge challenge in this area. And the opportunities to avoid that are largely by working with some of these, the big partners that are out there, but also going to some of these publishers directly. That, of course, then will cost you more money. If you're going to them directly and trying to enter into a direct partnership, it's going to be more money than trying to buy any of this inventory on the open marketplace. But I feel like if any ever there was a time for someone's hand to be forced, it should be now. Like, this is where your audience is. Your audience used to be here. No, they're now not. They're now on their mobile phones playing games. And maybe it's not even about gaming. We're seeing a massive e-commerce spike because everyone's stuck at home in hashtag lockdown. So actually, it's not just looking at the fraud in the gaming environment, but there's other apps out there as well that you could be embracing. And maybe try there to understand how you embrace in-app advertising. You can't use the same strategy that you use in other areas for other forms of media. You have to completely rethink how you would target this person. And we talk all the time about gamification, and it really is about gamification and actually engaging with them. And I think that also is a thing that terrifies brands. They're just not used to it.
And that's an interesting point, because I was just about to ask about that, because gamification is an opportunity for advertisers, but also for publishers, right? Is this something that they could be using to diversify their revenue streams? And publishers are, you know, so there are more people consuming content at the moment, but all the content's the same and the advertising revenue has reduced. So, you know, publishers are having a harder time than they've ever had before, arguably. Is there some potential opportunity for them here?
There's a great app that I use, a brain training app called Lumosity.
I love Lumosity.
It's fantastic. But I remember many years ago that Lumosity used to be available in mobile web format, in a web format, desktop format, I think it was The Guardian. That's where I first heard about it. And then many years later, when I saw it was an app, I was like, is that what I used to play all those years ago? So I think that these publishers could easily quickly create, even if it's just something simple like an archer with a bow and arrow trying to hit the target correctly. Like, there used to be some amazing websites out there with all these kind of random games. If you were able to create something very, very simple and put that on your site, it would really reattract people, because people are trying to find a way to spend to while away time, and you can easily get hooked on these things. If the mobile gaming apps can do it, and all we're doing is a simple map reconfiguration, you could do something similar quite easily.
And also, surely, I don't know about you guys, but I'm finding myself as well, when I'm on my mobile, wanting some other content, thinking, no, I can't just look at news anymore, because I know what if I go to the main news sites, I know what I'm going to see, and I want something else. So actually, haven't you potentially got a bit of a captured audience in this environment that you could quite easily convert to other activity? Lara, are you seeing, you having conversations with anyone about that in any of the stuff that you've been writing about recently?
Not so much on gaming, but your point around publishers, I think, is really valid, because as you say, people are looking for alternatives to bad news. And they're also, so basically as a publisher, you obviously have to provide that information, but the other things that publishers need to be doing is kind of being helpful. And yeah, providing entertainment, providing something you know, something that people are craving right now. And particularly on the kind of the live gaming aspect as well, there must be stuff that publishers can do, because obviously they can spread the word to get lots of people doing something at the same time, as at a time when people are craving togetherness. Did you see that HQ trivia?
Yes, I was just about to say that. Yeah.
You know, it's the perfect time for that comeback, because people, as I say, want to be doing things together now that they're socially isolated. And it also just gives you a conversation sparker for the next day when you do your Zoom meeting, because not a lot else is going on at the moment.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So I think I haven't really heard about publishers doing this, but I think all publishers are trying to think of ways. So particularly, you know, go back to the keyword blocking thing before, publishers are looking at ways they can provide other content that advertisers feel comfortable next to. I think that's a really great idea.
Yeah. And it strikes me as well that there's got to be an opportunity in gaming around sports as well, because that's a big part of people's lives that they're currently missing out on. Think of all of the people who are huge sport fans. And I'm not a massive sport fan. I'm much rather sort of, you know, I prefer playing it, or at least trying anyway, than actually watching it. But I wasn't even that worried about the cancellation of a lot of sporting seasons, including the Olympics, because it's postponed. It'll be there next year, until they started talking about tennis. And I was like, oh, no, man, I really like watching the tennis. But surely there's got to be, this is creating a big hole in a lot of people's lives, right? There's got to be some gaming opportunities associated with that.
I think as well, there's opportunity for gamification when it comes to helping keep people active. And even if they are stuck at home, anyway, and the Pokemon Go example is a fantastic one. Niantic have re-engineered the game so that it's available for indoor play and indoor use. So you haven't got to keep, obviously, it's largely used to be outside. And it's seen like a 67% weekly jump in global spending, because you're now able to comfortably use it inside. So it's getting people moving around their homes and doing different things and keeping them active and mobile. And I think that any sort of sporty type things, you know, even like some sort of like Pro Evolution type game that enables you to actually sort of practice kicking some sort of target. I don't know. There must be something around that to help keep people active during this as well.
Back to the days of the Wii.
Yeah, exactly.
Wii console.
That's a good idea, actually, Rachel.
Yeah, might dust that off. Get it out of the understairs cupboard. That brings us to the second part of the podcast, which is an opportunity to chat with you, Lara, about what you're focusing on at the moment in this very, very strange world that we're living in. Tell us what's going on for you, what's happening over at DigiDo.
Sure. The way I've been kind of positioning it and encouraging like colleagues to think about it is that we're here to be helpful at the moment, and we're obviously covering the news, so there will be stories, sadly, about, you know, layoffs and you know, strained financial positions and things. But ultimately, everybody is asking each other, what are you hearing? What are you hearing? Because people are looking for signs and trying to read the tea leaves as to what might happen next. So as an example, recently I wrote about lessons that can be learned from Italy, because they obviously entered their lockdown a little bit earlier and had their spike in cases and became the kind of epicenter, at least briefly, for the virus after China. There are some lessons to be learned from China, but I just thought that Italy was more of a similar media market to the UK and the US. And you know, people found that really useful. Again, you know, you can't compare apples to apples, but it's anything where we can point towards any sort of visibility, or just explaining how other people are handling this, to be frank, is useful. So the kind of things that we're looking at is, I mean, the other question that everyone is just asking is, where is the money coming from? So to our point about the you know, the gaming opportunity and things like that, I think, you know, those kind of like bright spots are what people are obviously looking for at the moment. And then there's the culture stuff too. Everybody's lives have been upended. Like I said, you know, we're not just dealing with a horrid, horrid virus. There's a huge potential mental health issue as well, and employers need to be doing the best that they can to look after their employees at this time. Not, you know, not only are people worrying about their financial situation over the next few months, but you know, it's a weird situation to be in. Some people are self-isolating at home alone. Some people are self-isolating, or sorry, not self-isolating, you know, that some people are staying at home with partners that they don't get along with, or worst, you know, abusive. So that, you know, and also people are juggling homeschooling and childcare and trying to do a 9-to-5 that inevitably isn't a 9-to-5 and everything blends into one. So there's so much. I mean, this is, you know, this is the biggest story in the world at the moment, and probably the biggest that we'll ever work on. So we're just trying to be helpful, as well as I say, obviously just covering the different twists and turns of the advertising and media industry as it rumbles on.
Yeah, for sure. And I imagine that, you know, it's changing the ways in which you guys are structuring and organising your content, and getting you focusing much more on your either longer form content as well as news, so your features, and maybe even it's changing the way that you're sort of just like I said, just organizing that content side of your business, because that's at the forefront now as opposed to anything that relies on in-person interaction.
Sure. I mean, I'm not like a DigiDay spokesperson, but I can, you know, there's some obvious things that are happening. Nobody's going to conferences, and I'm not flying to New York to meet sources at the moment. You know, there's lots of things that had to change. But as I said, I think right at the top of the conversation, like, this is the great accelerant for, you know, for good things as well as bad. Like, we had already been pivoting to being more of a subscription business anyway. This accelerates that, and we're doing, like, we're just making our member exclusive content like, frankly, a lot better than it was before. We were offering, you know, lots more things. We're, and as I say, especially at this time, and people are looking for utility and they're looking for data, they're looking for what other leaders are doing. This is kind of content that's worth paying for. So, yeah, like, of course, you know, so it just shifts things that were kind of already happening, but maybe a little bit slowly or slower than we'd have probably liked. It's just stepped it up a gear now. And yeah, obviously, like, personally, we're all working from home and all of that kind of stuff, boring, whatever. But it's actually quite interesting, because so in the first week, just like doing the journalism job, there were a lot of people that were kind of afraid of talking about this, because it was kind of too soon. They were not they were just adjusting to it themselves mentally. And I think there still are some companies that have a, you know, are not speaking to press about coronavirus rule for a lot of their, for basically everybody other than their top spokespeople. So that was like a little bit of a challenge at first. And obviously there's like the, obviously just a very big human impact. If you know somebody that has been affected badly by this, it can seem uncouth when a journalist phones you up and asks how, you know, where you're spending your ad money at the moment. So there is adjustment that's had to happen there. But then what's actually happened over the course of the few weeks, I think, just as people are shifting, that, you know, adjusting to it mentally in their own lives, is that people are kind of opening up a bit more. And frankly, we just wasted a lot of time traveling like around London or, you know, like I can do so many things a day.
Yeah.
You know, and we don't have to wait for the waiter to come over at the end and give us the bill and you know, all this kind of stuff. I mean, this stuff will come back again, because, you know, Zoom is no replacement for human contact and just serendipity and all those kinds of things. But I'd say I'm more productive. I hope my boss isn't listening to this, but like, you know, it does make you kind of, you can squeeze a lot more into the day. It also means you're just working like really hard and you're really frazzled at the end of it.
Yeah, that's true, because you're kind of always on, right? Not least of all because it's difficult sometimes to get a separation between things, especially if you're working across different time zones, but also too because, you know, the commute from the bedroom to the dining room or to the living room just isn't, you know, it's not enough of a change of scenery to signify to your brain that you're not working anymore, right? So it's totally different. But it's interesting, though, some of the things that you said there, Lara, particularly around people's willingness to sort of be a bit more open about what they're dealing with and how they're facing those issues. in a context that's relating to, you know, the advertising industry. I expect that in the early days, people were very nervous, particularly senior execs that either own or run businesses or are responsible for running their businesses, were probably really worried about what the hell this was going to mean and what they were going to have to do internally. There was probably some really, initially some very dark days where they thought, shit, we're going to have to, you know, reduce our staff headcount. We're going to have to do some really uncomfortable, difficult things, and where is our future? Whereas now it's a bit, I wonder if it's a bit more the case that everybody feels like we're all in this together now. There are going to be some people that are better prepared than others, but actually there's no shame in talking quite openly about the challenges that you're facing because everybody's facing them. No one is immune from this. No one's having an easy time. Even the world of online gaming, there's still going to be something ingrained in what's happening in those businesses that are challenging as a result of this.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think like people can be forgiven for this as well, but like the first reaction was to be like quite myopic, I suppose, and just like, shit, this is going to really affect our business. Will we still be in business? Like, and looking at like, oh no, we can't, like, what's going to happen to that conference? And oh, is CAN going to happen? And like all of that kind of stuff. And then it took a while, I think, for people to realize just how big and global this thing is. And to your point, every company is affected. You know, Tesco and Sainsbury's are having strains at the moment. They, you know, they might have lots of money coming in, but obviously they have supply issues and staffing issues and, you know, real and frank health and safety issues because they're becoming, you know, the only place that you can actually visit at the moment. So yeah, to people's comfort, I think just at first, also because not a lot of people were talking at first, and then as the time rolls on, and you see that, oh, my competitor spoke to DigiDay, maybe like it wouldn't be so bad, or like, you know, oh actually that person got it completely wrong when they spoke to DigiDay. I want to give the opposite view. So it kind of opened up a bit. As I say, I think there still are some PR policies where only like the CEO can speak about it. I guess for fear of people just sticking their foot in their mouth or something. But I think, it's certainly, like, people just want to learn from each other, I think. And also, you know, people want to be helpful at this point in time. So whether that is, you know, the advertisers doing like big grand gestures, you know, the brew dogs of this world making hand sanitizer, or whether it's literally down to like executive PR level and people just want to give advice, like, you know, always look for the helpers in these kinds of instances. And also you do really see, like, it brings out the best and worst in people, and you really see people's true colors at this point of time. Some of the press releases I'm getting, Jesus Christ, like, so tone deaf, unbelievable. And I won't name and shame because I know everyone wants to know, but like, there's no point giving that stuff any oxygen. But my Lord, some of the stuff that's coming in.
God, do you sometimes politely reply going, don't think, really, guys, you need to rethink this? Or do you just log it in the, that's a disaster?
I've become like a lot more zen recently. I'm not sure why, but I do the whole like taking 10 seconds and then thinking, do I reply or do I just, you know, move on? It's not worth it. It's really not worth it. There's better things to spend time on.
Yeah, I'm sure you do, yeah. And I think you're so right. It's a bit associated with the conversations that we had at the start of the podcast as well, is that, you know, there are certainly a lot of negative things rolling around at the moment, and there's a lot of bad things happening, a lot of really challenging things that everyone's facing. But it's not all bad. There is some good in this. We will see some good in this. And so you're right. The approach of just thinking, be as helpful as you possibly can, be as informative as you possibly can, is probably a good, a good steady path to tread in the midst of all of this. And yeah, I totally agree. How much time did we waste sometimes getting from A to B? Not just in London, across continents as well. What do you reckon, Lindsay? How's the commute in Walthamstow?
I mean, it's tough. Traffic can get pretty bad, but on the stairs in particular. But no, I agree. Like, and the stress levels seem to reduce. Like, you realise just how stressful commuting actually is when you're
moving around.
And you think, that's because I haven't had to get on the tube this morning, and I didn't even think about that until I had to do it anymore. I'm like, oh my God. I can, you know, this is, I think this will change, fundamentally change the way businesses approach remote working, flexible working, from now on, because they'll realise, they'll see that teams are more productive, that teams, apart from the isolation factor, when it comes to the actual working factor, teams do probably have better mental health. And there's definitely going to be ways around this. I think it's going to be really important going forward.
Yeah, I really reckon there's going to be a bit of a revolution in the way that companies build their office environments. Like, you know, it's great to have big fancy offices, totally pointless if no one can actually get into them. And actually so much can be done remotely. Do we need to have an office that can accommodate everyone all the time? I think that's really going to change things.
Far in the distance, if I look out my bathroom window, in the distance I can see Canary Wharf. And it's weird to look at Canary Wharf at nighttime and think, they are just defunct buildings at the moment. It's such a strange thing.
I've been wondering about things like looting. No one's going to go to Canary Wharf to loot. Well, they might do. But I'm thinking about the kind of the absence of people in parts of London, which are normally totally packed. That must be really weird. I don't know what that looks like right now.
No. Yeah, you see some really eerie pictures of like Chinatown and Carnaby Street and Westfield. Check them out. It's odd.
Meantime, suburban southwest London, there's lots of people around. Obviously, not in my very near vicinity, doing their daily exercise walks up the park, walking the poor dogs that are now sick of getting walked, that are hiding from their owners because they've had enough, that sort of activity.
So he's done, absolutely done with the walking.
Yeah, you're torturing your dog at the moment, aren't you, Lindsay?
He hates it.
Sent through a little video to the Exchange Wire Telegram group yesterday. It was very amusing. Poor little guy. Okay, that concludes our podcast for the week. Thank you very much, Lara. It was great to have you on as a guest. Sorry that it couldn't be in the office and around our lovely radio mics, but never mind. Let's think of it as a celebratory opportunity when we're all released from isolation to actually have you in the office one day.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Good to see you there, Lindsay. And thanks for joining me. And that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.